Welcome to another edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, as usual, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we've got some exciting stuff to share with you on today's program. In a little while, we're going to talk a little bit about the very, very profound effects of stress on the heart, as documented in a recent study. We're also going to talk about one of my favorite nutrients for psychiatric problems. It's actually a prescription medication, although it's a vitamin, and we're going to talk about it in just a moment. But before we do that, I want to talk about one of my favorite subjects, which is poop. Yeah, poop. There's an intense interest in poop these days because we're coming to realize that poop is extremely important for our health. And by that I mean that the composition of the bacteria that make up your poop, by the way, two-thirds of the weight of your bowel movements consists of bacteria, not simply food waste products. We used to think, well, this is just broken down food, it's sort of compost, but actually a large percentage of the mass of our bowel movements is made up of the trillions and trillions of bacteria that inhabit our digestive tracts. And this may have a profound impact on our health. There's the hygiene hypothesis that posits that exposure to germs in our environment can influence our risk for autoimmune disease, for digestive disorders, for allergies. And the problem in our modern society is that we just don't get exposed to enough germs. We live in antiseptic environments. We're born, many of us, via C-section, which doesn't permit us a trip down the vaginal canal, which colonizes babies' gastrointestinal tracts with beneficial bacteria, natural bacteria, that prime the immune system for normal reactivity. And on it goes. There's even studies that suggest that mood may be related to the bacteria that inhabit our intestinal tract. We certainly know about intestinal toxicity causing people to feel a sense of profound fatigue and malaise. We know about the yeast connection. We've been talking about the yeast connection for decades now. And when we first talked about it, many conventional medical experts scoffed and thought, well, there's no way that yeast can cause so many profound changes in the body. But we now know that yeast and harmful bacteria may account for many disorders. There's even the possibility that our weight may be governed by the bacteria in our intestinal tracts. And that has been dramatized via studies that show that you can take a skinny rat, and if you transplant fecal material from a fat rat into the skinny rat will turn fat, and vice versa. Fat rats can be cured of their obesity by a fecal transplant from a skinny rat. Please don't try this at home. This is not yet authorized for self-administration or self-care, and it's even the whole field of fecal transplantation is very, very strictly regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. There are a few places where you can get fecal transplants if you're at death's door because of a severe diarrheal disease, say with Clostridium difficile, but these facilities are few and far between. So research is underway. We're trying to characterize the intestinal bacteria by means of tests. I've been doing stool tests on patients since the 1980s, trying to determine if imbalances in intestinal bacteria were at the root of their problems. This is a problem that we refer to as dysbiosis, which doesn't mean that you have a terrible parasite or a serious GI infection. It just means that you've got an imbalance of the bacteria in your intestinal tract. You've got too many bad bugs and not enough good bugs. And it's very hard for us to get a handle on this with tests. Even the present technology is lacking, and we barely are scratching the surface in our knowledge of what's normal and what's optimal. We use probiotics to modify our intestinal flora, and certainly probiotics may be beneficial, but we don't even know precisely which probiotics are called for in certain circumstances. Some people do extremely well with certain probiotics. Other people seem to be intolerant. It may be that certain probiotics are better for certain conditions, And indeed, research is underway to pinpoint which probiotics are best, for example, to prevent urinary tract infections in women or vaginal infections in women versus curing colitis or Crohn's disease. There's certainly a lot of research interest in the role of bacteria in gastrointestinal problems. Irritable bowel syndrome, now you can go to the supermarket and buy an active probiotic product that's supposed to regularize your digestion and help you with constipation or gas and bloating. This is an emerging science, and more research is underway. So I found it very fascinating, and I posted this on my Facebook page. By the way, friend me on Facebook, and you'll see lots of the stuff that I post. It's a good way to get the heads up on some of the latest information. This is a posting at the website humanfoodproject.com. And the subheading of that website is American Gut. There's a project, a sub-project within the Human Food Project, which is entitled The Anthropology of Microbes. It's the American Gut Project. And what it involves, it's quite fascinating. It's a crowdsourcing project to gather as much information as possible about what's in the poop of Americans and indeed people throughout the world. Okay, what's crowdsourcing? Crowdsourcing is a way that you can gather enormous amounts of information through social media and participation of myriads of people who follow websites. And so I'm going to give these people a little bit of a boost. Here's what they're talking about. It's simple to join. Donate $99 to the project, the American Gut Project, and we will send you a home sampling kit. What kind of home sampling kit? It's a stool collection kit, folks. In return, we will provide you with a list of the bacteria in your sample and their relative abundance and show how your bacterial community compares to others in the study based on the diet and lifestyle question you fill out when you take your sample. The more people we have in the study, the more we will learn and be able to tell you. 100% of the donations go to the BioFrontiers Institute at the University of Colorado Boulder and something called the Earth Microbiome Project. The microbiome is fast becoming a buzzword for the study of the contents of the gastrointestinal tract. And it's like, you know, we had the Human Genome Project, which mapped the human chromosome, and we completed that project. Well, now we have the Earth Microbiome Project, which attempts to map the composition of the gastrointestinal tracts of people throughout the world under different circumstances, taking different diets, and having various types of disease histories. Or antibiotic usage histories. So what you do is you take samples from yourself. There's a convenient mailer. They say we'll mail you your kit and easy to follow instructions. And so that's something that they're urging you to participate in. And so you go to the website humanfoodproject.com. They have a nice little video which explains the project. But here's the interesting part. They are looking at the impact of different diets. So whether you're on the Ornish diet or vegetarian diet or you're an omnivore or if you're on a low glycemic index diet or a paleo diet, eating lots of meat, they want to know if it has an impact on your gastrointestinal tract. Author Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, is into this. He's donating a sample of his microbiome to the project. And so there are celebrity contributors. And here's where it gets interesting. They have different levels of participation. By the way, you can also characterize the microbiome of your dog, should you choose to do so. And but there are levels at which you can participate. So I found this kind of interesting. Here's the basic level, $99. Find out who's in your gut. They do genetic sequencing. You will get a certificate suitable for framing with a readout of your microbes and a view of your microbes in the context of other people's. Well, that's nice. Okay, thank you. $180 gets you microbes for two. See what you're sharing. You can find out if you and your spouse, or the PC term, your partner, are actually sharing the same bacterial species. Or perhaps, you know, you get up close and personal with your pooch. You can find out if you and your pooch now have something in common inhabiting your respective gastrointestinal tracts. It doesn't end there, folks, because you can also get microbes for three. For $260, you can have a sequencing of three stool samples if there are three of you in your home, and so on it goes. $320 gets you microbes for four. $500 gets you a week of feces. There will be DNA extraction and RNA sequencing of up to seven samples. Collect a stool sample every day of the week and find out if there's perhaps you're undertaking a diet change. Maybe you're going to go on a fast, or you're going to go on a vegetarian diet, or go on a very low sugar diet, or eliminate gluten. You can find out if there's actually an impact from day to day on your stool composition. But there's more, folks. For $1,500, you can get an all-in-the-family assessment, which is even more specific, because they will fragment all the DNA in the sample, grind it up, and sequence it in small pieces, and it all sounds very high-tech, but the information is even more detailed. For $2,500, you can go beyond bacteria. There's a deeper shotgun metagenome and virome characterization of a single stool sample. And plus, they'll also analyze the fungi in your gut. My goodness, you know, my stool tests, they do not cost $2,500, but I guess these are super sophisticated stool tests that they're offering for $2,500. But it doesn't end there, folks. For $3,750, you can get a deeper shotgun metagenomic characterization up to seven stool samples. That's even better. But wait, folks, there's more. For $5,000, you can get a genome from your gut. And this is a very ultra-sophisticated analysis. You will get a framed poster of the assembled genome showing differences to its close relatives. So, you know, that may be important. Certainly a conversation piece that you can hang up, in your, maybe next to a portrait of family members in your dining room. They caution, only the serious need inquire for this $5,000 profile. So you'll have to email them specifically to express your interest before signing up for this one. But it doesn't end there. It just keeps on going. For $15,000, you can get RNA expression profiling of up to five samples, which tells you not only who is in your gut, but what genes they have turned on. How fascinating. It's ideal for seeing the responses to probiotic yogurt, for example, or short-term dietary changes. So this is, again, only the serious need to inquire for this level of testing. $15,000 for processing your stool tests. And finally, an ultra-deluxe profile as part of this humanfoodproject.com/American Gut. A $25,000 deluxe profile. Hundreds of genomes from your gut. This is like riding on the first space flight for passengers into outer space. Be among the first in the world to get the most detailed map of your gut microbiome and help us push the state of the art in high-throughput sequence technology of microbial communities. We will perform ultra-deep sequencing of your microbiome sample aimed at generating as many individual bacterial genomes as possible. Again, this is for true aficionados, only the serious need inquire for the 25,000 ultra deluxe profile of your stool microbiome. So there it is. For those of you who have a boundless fascination with what's going on inside of you, the opportunity exists to learn more and also advance the cause of science through the American Gut Project. Check it out if you're interested. It'll be interesting to read the results when they publish them. And now for something completely different. Let's take on the subject of depression with a nutrient that is now available as a prescription medication. Yeah, it's something that doctors have to pull out the prescription pad to write for. It's a B vitamin called L-methylfolate. It's the active form of the vitamin folate or folic acid. And, you know, we know that folic acid is helpful for lowering something called homocysteine. Homocysteine is thought to increase the risk for cardiovascular disease. Recent studies on homocysteine have shown that by giving B vitamins to people who have heart disease, it doesn't reverse the heart disease. So people have lost interest in folic acid and B vitamins. That is conventional cardiologists and most of the mainstream medical profession. But it appears that lowering homocysteine has benefits in terms of slowing the progression of dementia. It may work better on small vessel disease than large vessel disease, and the heart disease mostly is the result of narrowing of the large pipes, the coronary arteries that supply blood to the rapidly metabolizing heart muscles. But in the brain, tiny blood vessels course throughout the brain, and when those blood vessels become occluded, that's when dementia occurs. And high levels of homocysteine appear to affect the small blood vessels. So B12 and folic acid, very, very important for brain function. We've known for a long time that certain cases of dementia and depression can be alleviated with B12. B12 shots are a very, very ancient part of doctors' armamentarium to perk up tired patients. And we know that especially methylated B12, that's the type of B12 we like to use when we're treating depression, when taken orally or sublingually, has a nice effect on the brain. Now, a pharmaceutical manufacturer has done the due diligence to register a ultra-potent form of folic acid that is methylated and therefore body-ready and bioavailable as an option for the treatment of depression. And that's fascinating because now I'm beginning to see patients coming in who are getting Deplin from their psychiatrists. And when I prescribe Deplin for my patients, their psychiatrists don't bat an eyelash. In the past, they would say, oh, you know, vitamin supplements, you know, that's not proven. But they're excited about this because there are actually studies that suggest that Deplin can be helpful in depression. So it's available in two forms, 7.5 milligrams and 15 milligrams of L-methylfolate. What is Deplin? Well, it's a medical food. Is the active form of folate needed by some individuals who, because of a genetic condition or otherwise, can't get the levels needed to produce the important neurotransmitters associated with mood, serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. I'm reading from their website at deplin.com. And how does it work? Well, it appears that if you don't have adequate methylation in your brain, this is the buzzword now, in orthomolecular medicine, when methylation is faulty, and there's some people who, for genetic reasons, don't have good methylation, they are more prone to psychiatric disorders. And so Deplin can help to enhance levels of neurotransmitters. It can act alone. In particular, it seems to work well with SSRI medications like Prozac and Zoloft and Paxil and Lexapro. These are medications whose activity seems to be enhanced. I call this hamburger helper for psychiatric medications. When the psychiatric medications leave you short, then Deplin seems to help the medications work better. And I've actually seen remarkable results in some patients, either with or without psychiatric medications. I have one patient who is a 94-year-old woman who, you know, predictably at 94, you feel a little slowed down. She was feeling cranky, irritable, didn't want to go out anymore, lost interest. And so her psychiatrist put her on an antidepressant. Well, it helped a little bit for a while, but then it left her feeling, you know, not so good. He raised the level of the antidepressant. I think she was on Lexapro. And ultimately, you know, sort of a middling result. She got a little bit of a benefit. Some days she felt better, some days she didn't. So I prescribed Deplin. And within a week or two, her energy improved, her mood brightened, and now she's doing quite well. And in fact, she's a remarkable patient because she now uses an iPad, which is something that she recently learned to do. Her grandchildren presented her with an iPad. And she's fascinated by all the opportunities to look at what people are doing on Facebook. She communicates with family members. She likes a lot of posting on Facebook. She's having a great time. And I really think that is in large measure attributable to adding high-dose L-methylfolate to her psychiatric drug regimen. There are other patients who do well with just folic acid alone. I noticed as early as 20 years ago that I had some patients who responded to high doses of folic acid. One patient that I see has been getting folic acid injections. She does so routinely. Every couple of weeks she comes in for a folic acid injection because she says it makes her feel better. Well, she really was a pioneer because in those days we said, well, who knows what that's about? You know, if it feels good, do it. But now we know that folic acid is a mood enhancer. And here there are many medications that actually deplete folic acid. Medications like Lamictal, medications like Depakote, anti-seizure medications like Tegretol and others will deplete folic acid. Also, azulfadine for inflammatory bowel disease and rheumatoid arthritis. Oral contraceptives will do it. Metformin, or glucophage, commonly used to treat type 2 diabetes, will deplete folic acid. Prozac itself will actually interfere with folic acid. Coumadin is known to interfere with folic acid. So many older patients are on blood thinners, Coumadin, and their folic acid may be depleted. So there are also many medical conditions that are associated with low folic acid. Diabetes, Crohn's disease, colitis because of malabsorption. Patients who are on chronic acid-blocking medication, of which there are tens of millions, may not absorb folic acid properly. And excessive use of alcohol or smoking or poor nutrition where you don't eat your greens, folic acid is present in most green leafy vegetables. It's also present in liver, but who likes liver? Just the aging process itself decreases the ability of people to convert folic acid into its active methylated form. Interestingly, they've done studies. Up to 70% of patients with depression have a genetic flaw, which is called MTHFR polymorphism. It's something that we can test in the doctor's office. If you're suffering from depression, we can actually do a blood test on that. It is somewhat expensive, but it will confirm that you have MTHFR defects, which cause an inability to properly methylate, and therefore you need methyl donors in the form of methylated B12 or methylcobalamin, and also methylfolate and companion nutrients like B6 and dimethylglycine and N-acetylcysteine and SAMe can also promote that. That's why many of those have antidepressant effects. So pretty cool. Therefore, lots of doctors now are recognizing that this is a harmless intervention. I mean, you can't go wrong with taking high doses of folic acid. It's, you know, at worst, it's going to be a waste of money and time. But at best, you may have an improvement in your mood. Now, here's another wrinkle, is that the self-same medication, L-methylfolate, is also another prescription drug. And it's called Serifolin NAC, spelled C-E-R-E-F-O-L-I-N. And it is marketed for a different indication, which is mild cognitive impairment or early dementia. You know, there's not a cure for advanced Alzheimer's disease, but certainly patients who have memory problems and focus problems, they may benefit from Serifolin when teamed with N-acetylcysteine, which is a potent generator of glutathione, which is a vital nutrient for the brain. So this is another cool product that I'm prescribing for patients who are aging, with memory problems, with neurological diseases. I think it's a very, very nice way to boost levels of methylated folate in the brain where it's needed to combat brain disorders, to alleviate depression and mood problems, but also to stave off cognitive decline that occurs as patients age. So I'm glad to see that this is being recognized by the medical establishment. It's even available as a drug. And ask your doctor for a prescription of Deplin or Serifolin NAC. If they don't know about it, have them research it. I think that they're going to find it a helpful option. And what's going to encourage them to use it more is the fact that it is now available as a prescription. That's going to make them think it's on the up and up, because it's not something that you have to go to a health food store for. Yeah, I mean, it's equivalent to things that are available in health food stores, but it's a prescription. So that's going to increase acceptance among mainstream medical doctors. You know, we all encounter stress, everyday events that make us miserable and cause us to feel nervous or bummed out. But the ultimate expression of stress is a condition called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's a quantum leap above the ordinary stress that we normally encounter. But it provides us with a living laboratory to study the profound effects of stress. And so it was that, by the way, PTSD, to describe it, I've actually had patients in my office who are returning either Vietnam-era veterans early in the 1980s when I began my practice. I would see many of them. And then, of course, in the subsequent wars, we've had other people who've come back with shattering battlefield experiences. It's not inevitable that people develop post-traumatic stress. It may have to do with certain genetic or constitutional factors, people's pre-existing attitudes and personal levels of resilience. But there's clearly some events that one encounters, particularly in wartime, that make it highly likely that you'll suffer from PTSD. Of course, PTSD can occur outside of the context of war. It can occur if you are subject to violent physical abuse or even verbal and psychological abuse. Certainly, sexual abuse is something that can result in a profound sense of PTSD. People who are survivors of terrible disasters, survivors of the 9/11 atrocities, may suffer from PTSD. And also people who are survivors of events like plane crashes or where other family members are injured or killed. These are setup conditions for PTSD. And I actually recall very well one of my first encounters with a PTSD patient. He came to my office. He stated immediately that he was suffering from PTSD. He appeared to be nervous and very flat emotionally. But suddenly there was some construction nearby, and somebody used a nail gun, and he immediately shot up out of his seat. as if suddenly he felt like he was transported back to some remote battlefield. And he started shaking, and you know, finally the noise died down, and he calmed down, sat down, and said, "Doc, that's how I always react to loud noise. It drives me crazy. It takes me right back to the battlefield where I was under fire and saw many of my comrades killed." So that's a classic instance of PTSD. PTSD patients have persistent frightening thoughts and memories of their trauma. They may and often do experience sleep problems. They typically feel detached or numb, and they may be easily startled. So the net result of that is that these repeated emotional triggers during everyday life in persons with PTSD, I'm quoting now Dr. Viola Vaccarino, who is a professor in the Department of Medicine at Emory University. She says, repeated emotional triggers during everyday life in persons with PTSD could affect the heart by causing frequent increases in blood pressure, heart rate, and heartbeat rhythm abnormalities that in susceptible individuals could lead to a heart attack. I mean, what you get is you get a cascade of stress hormones. They include cortisol and adrenaline. High levels of cortisol, by the way, we measure cortisol often in our patients just to assess, you know, kind of give them a report card on their stress levels. And many of our patients, you know, busy, hyper patients that I see in my practice in New York City, they have very high levels of cortisol. They're under constant stress. And so high levels of cortisol, you know, sort of a, it doesn't diagnose PTSD, but it shows that the body is overproducing stress hormones. But typically, the high levels of adrenaline, activation of the sympathetic nervous system, can tax the heart, make the heart beat faster, can cause the blood literally to curdle, attracting platelets to areas of blood vessel narrowing. The blood vessels constrict as the blood pressure goes up, and this can be a setup for cardiovascular events. So they did some ingenious research on this. Typically, twin studies are very cool for studying different types of phenomena in medicine. So they take twins, one of whom has been exposed to a certain circumstance and one of them not exposed to a certain circumstance. So they actually collected 562 middle-aged twins from the Vietnam-era twin registry. So one set of each of these twins had been diagnosed with PTSD, and the other was, quote, a normal middle-aged person. I mean, it's not that these people are exempt from the risk of cardiovascular disease. They're just normal middle-aged guys, where, in fact, there is a high incidence of cardiovascular disease on average, but they didn't suffer from PTSD. And what they found was the incidence of heart disease was 22.6%. in the twin member who suffered from PTSD, but it was just 9% in those without PTSD. So what's that? That's about 2.5 times higher in patients who were suffering from PTSD. And then they actually did something that, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words, and I'm looking at a picture here that I think you can imagine. They did nuclear scans of the heart, which are ways of visualizing blood flow to the heart. And what they found is that individuals with PTSD had almost twice as many areas of reduced blood flow to the heart as individuals without PTSD. So if you look at the image of someone without PTSD, pretty nice blood flow throughout the heart. You know, pretty, it's all, you know, the heart fills up, the image indicates blood flow and the heart fills up with blood. In the patient with PTSD, they're like Swiss cheese-sized holes in the heart where the blood's not getting to the heart muscle. So on average, individuals with PTSD had almost twice as many areas of reduced blood flow to the heart as individuals without PTSD. Now, you know, those of you who are smart are going to say, look, PTSD causes you to pay a little less attention to your lifestyle, right? You know, if you're nervous, you're going to smoke more, you're going to drink more, You're not going to eat good food. Maybe you're going to gain a lot of weight because you're pigging out. And you won't exercise as more because you just feel dull and flat and unmotivated. Well, they actually thought of that. The researchers accounted for lifestyle factors such as smoking, physical activity level, and drinking, and even major depression and other psychiatric diagnoses. So they just said, look, the only difference between these groups, there could be, you know, they matched smokers to smokers, drinkers to drinkers, exercisers to exercisers, non-exercisers to exercisers, overweight individuals to overweight individuals. They accounted for that. And they found that still there was a specific risk factor for cardiovascular disease if you had PTSD. And in fact, there wasn't even a link between PTSD and having a history of high blood pressure, diabetes, or obesity. It wasn't that those people with PTSD had more high blood pressure or badly controlled blood sugar or were fatter. It was simply that their high levels of stress had an erosive effect on the heart itself. So, I mean, it's a cautionary tale because, look, I mean, let's face it, not all of us suffer from this extreme level. I mean, this is the ultimate form of a stress disorder. But it illustrates the highly pernicious effects of stress hormones on the body, and in particular the heart, but also you could read in the brain, the liver, the kidneys, other parts of the body may be harmed or damaged by a toxic overload of stress hormones. And it just accentuates, what an important role we have as health practitioners in identifying and addressing stress as a factor in the causation and perpetuation of many diseases. And how do we address that? Well, we address that through, A, making patients aware that stress is a factor. I mean, show patient a test result that shows they have high levels of cortisol, and maybe they'll do something about it. Maybe they'll make changes in their life. But also good talk therapy, exercise, relaxation methods, such as meditation, relaxation techniques. These can go a long way towards alleviating PTSD. And then there are also natural interventions. Fish oil seems to tone down the sympathetic nervous system. It can actually help reduce the risk of arrhythmias and improve sympathetic nervous system tone. Magnesium is ultra important for patients suffering from chronic stress. Either oral magnesium or in some extreme cases, intravenous magnesium is a great stress buster. I just saw a patient suffering from anxiety attacks. I prescribed magnesium taurate, which is helpful for restoring magnesium and supports the heart, makes it less likely that you'll suffer from runaway tachycardia or cardiac arrhythmias. And the guy already says that his episodes of panic and stress are dramatically alleviated. So there are natural interventions that are very important for addressing stress. And it has a very important role in the cardiovascular risk equation. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much for joining us for this edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Make sure you go to drhoffman.com or iTunes, where you can download more episodes and or subscribe. Until the next time.